More than 500 men and women from Eielson Air Force Base will be deployed to Suwon, South Korea, beginning Monday. They'll join nearly 350 airmen from the lower 48 for two related training exercises. Once at Suwon Air Base, the American team will join up with South Korean Air Force personnel to set up a provisional wing. In civilian terms, that means putting the people and the equipment in place, like a mini base in case of war. This exercise, called Cope Jade, will be linked up with a combat ammunition production exercise where airmen will be building bombs and loading them onto airplanes. This is the first time these two exercises have been held back-to-back, and the first time that real aircraft will be used for the bomb-loading drills. Despite the tensions between North and South Korea, Eielson's Captain Sandra Trober stresses that the two training exercises should not be interpreted as deployment for a possible war in Korea.
Cope Jade and CAPEX are pre-planned annual training exercises. They are not connected to what is currently happening in Korea.
Advanced military teams are already in Korea preparing for Cope Jade. Both exercises should be completed by April 20th. Airmen sent over from Eielson and the lower 48 should be home by the first week in May. In Fairbanks, I'm Vicki Dorn.
Three, two, one. The Department of Community and Regional Affairs acts as the staff for the Local Boundary Commission. And for the last year or so, the DCRA has been preparing a draft report for the commission that recommends they deny detaching North Pole so it can fashion its own borough. Deputy Commissioner Lamar Cotton says that division would run counter to two constitutional principles.
One is the idea of creating or having a minimum number of local governments, and we felt that the existing borough adequately provides those services, and that it's contrary to the Constitution to create two boroughs when one is efficient. Secondly, that the existing borough, North Star Borough, along with if there was in fact a North Pole Borough, neither one of them would meet the standard of embracing a common geographic area.
The department's proposal is only a recommendation. Citizens of both North Pole and Fairbanks can comment on the finding, but the final say lies with the Boundary Commission, which could hold hearings as early as July. John Glotfelty with the Breakaway Movement says his group was expecting the DCRA's recommendation.
People need to keep an eye out. They need to speak out. The bureaucrats, the staff technicians from the Boundary Commission will be in the interior in mid-May to explain their perceptions of what the process is. Folks have questions. I would show up and ask them, because obviously over a period of time, we're not singing off the same sheet of music.
Last year, more than 1,600 residents of North Pole and Salcha signed a petition asking for the new borough. If the commission approves that petition, it goes to the area voters. On the other hand, Glotfelty says, his group doesn't have the money to fight the case in court if the Boundary Commission decides against them. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. State game managers don't know if they can prevent the Nalchina herd from crashing, but they say the odds improve if hunters can reduce the herd to 40,000. It currently numbers more than 50,000 and growing. Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Jeff Hughes likened the herd situation to interior lands during a bad fire season. Game managers, Hughes says, are waiting for the chance lightning strike to ignite a blaze.
We believe we're in an extreme fire situation. We may not be to the hot day in mid-July, but we're approaching it. And if we get a decline and it starts, it could be catastrophic.
Hughes and other game managers call the efforts to reduce the herd an experiment, one they've never tried on this scale before. And board members agree. Vic Van Ballenberg of Anchorage doesn't go along with the Fish and Game's alarm, but he supports the program that will allow thousands of subsistence hunters a chance to take up to 5,000 bulls and an unlimited number of other resident hunters an opportunity to take up to 10,000 cows.
It's unprecedented to manage the caribou herd in Alaska, or I think anywhere in North America, by trying to take a very large harvest to prevent that herd from increasing. It's unprecedented here, certainly. We've never done it before. It will be a historic first.
There are two basic seasons, fall and winter, and hunters may have good access to game. The Nalchina herd customarily crossed several roads, including the Richardson Highway. That raised the fears of some board members, like Larry Holmes, who worried about safety and enforcement.
I've never had a Tier 2 permit, but I've been up there on the highway when the hunt occurs, and it's just people in pickup trucks with, sitting in the back of. You got one driver and everybody else sitting in the back of the truck, four or five folks with rifles hanging out, and they see a caribou and everybody piles out and either starts shooting or running.
Game managers say they share Holmes's concerns, but for many hunters, road access is important. But manager Bob Toby says if huge numbers of caribou stay near the highway, the department could beef up patrols and establish mile-wide corridors along the highways where hunting would not be allowed. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
The reason the board made that distinction was because after July 1st, there's an increased likelihood that some of these black bears have been on salmon streams. So the staggered time was designed by the board to take into account the fish issue.
There was a time when anthropologists and the people they studied were worlds apart. Scholars did the fieldwork, and the people watched them come and go. Today, some of the borders between them are slipping away. The voice of indigenous people is much stronger, and the academy, once predominantly white, has a growing number of native students and professors who are influencing and being influenced by the field. Miranda Wright, director of the Doyon Foundation, returned to UAS for a master's in cultural anthropology to become an agent of change.
There's a lot of concern from the native community that they have been basically misrepresented through anthropology. And I think one of the biggest responsibilities today for anthropologists and the whole discipline is to make sure that those types of perceptions are dispelled.
Wright believes anthropology has to put its work into the hands of the people so they can use it too. While this notion of anthropology as an applied discipline isn't new, as communities collect oral histories and try to preserve lifeways, building a bridge between the two does seem more likely. UAS Deanna Kingston, who's both Tlingit and white, is trying to build that bridge within herself.
I know of several other students who are half, and they grew up outside, and they've come to Fairbanks, you know, to take advantage of the Native Language Center or to learn more about their people or just to be here and to be closer to their communities. And, you know, they bring with them the same sorts of things I do, and they realize the situation that they're in, that they're between both worlds. They're not really part of it, but sort of.
Like Kingston, Professor Phyllis Ann Fast has used anthropology to find her own way. She sees the field responding to a changing world.
Anthropology is looking at what is happening to Native cultures and responding emotionally and intellectually to the struggles they see of the people that they are trying to understand. We, as Native people, are going through many emotional struggles, but they are also very personal, economic, and they have direct impact on the struggles that we have just to be able to get up in the morning and live. So they are very different kinds of struggles, but they're both genuine struggles.
Fast says walking in two worlds is awkward and stressful, like trying to speak two languages at once. Her colleague, Professor Phyllis Morrow, says the hard questions students and scholars are dealing with will help change the field.
Those kinds of very hard questions about what happens when I go into my community and I have to use this framework that I'm learning that is both useful and doesn't fit, that is both welcome and unwelcome, where someone else is trying to give me another framework, where I have another framework inside of me, perhaps, you know, for people who've grown up in those communities, but there's not an easy fit between them. So in this coming of age, I think everyone is struggling to find the places where some kind of new framework can be constructed, or new framework.
This weekend's discussions were at the 23rd annual meeting of the Alaska Anthropology Association with over 300 participants. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Board of Game initially approved go-ahead for Wolf Control in Game Management Unit 19D East last fall, contingent on the results of a wolf control study by the National Academy of Sciences and the approval of the Commissioner of Fish and Game. The plan was scheduled to get underway in July of 1997, but at its March meeting, the Game Board moved up the start date to this July because of what McGrath Area Department biologist Jack Whitman describes as dire circumstances.
In 19D East, the areas that we've surveyed, the ratio of most to wolves is about 12 to 1. And normally, when we get down around 35 or 40 to 1, that should send up a red flag and people should get a little concerned. Well, we are so far below that, every mortality is meaningful now.
Most biologists agree with Whitman's take on the local moose-wolf situation, but not all. A minority in the field believe that high wolf numbers aren't a credit for there being any moose left at all along the upper Kuskokwim following a string of extremely heavy snow winters. Their hypothesis is that moose habitat is limited during deep snow winters and that natural moose-wolf ratios play a key role in preventing mass starvation. Regardless, native organizations like the Tanana Chiefs Conference and the public in general are pushing for more moose via wolf control, and the Game Board is listening. Along with pushing up the start date for the implementation of a wolf control program, at its last meeting, the Game Board also deleted a list of control options from the earlier Upper Kuskokwim proposal.
At this point, the only thing that it says is it must be efficient, it must be humane, and poisons are not legal.
That language leaves the door wide open for the aerial shooting of wolves, a practice many McGrath area residents remember boosting moose numbers in the 1960s and have pushed for the return of. Whether the public, the department, or both might be involved in such measures is still a question. Wolf control in Alaska is currently on hold as the state awaits the results of the yet-to-begin National Academy of Sciences study. Meantime, Fish and Game Commissioner Frank Rue isn't selling the Upper Kuskokwim proposal short, but says the legislature might be.
The Senate has cut quite a bit, about $1.5 million out of the sort of the heart of the management program, including wolves and intensive management, so I'm not sure what will be left and who will be left to work on this kind of thing. But at any rate, if we survive that, then we'll know better what our budget is for this coming year. And I would expect that this spring we'd be out there in McGrath and the region beginning to talk to people and looking at the specifics.
If sufficient funding allows the program to go ahead and Commissioner Rue gives the final plan his okay, McGrath's Whitman says wolf control could begin in Unit 19D East as early as October. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Forty airmen and soldiers are spending the week in Galena to take part in Amalgam Warrior, a North American Air Defense Command exercise. Senior Master Sergeant Clem Umau says this is the first operation of this magnitude involving the Galena base since it was downsized in October 1993.
Galena is a forward operating location so that we could go out there and in other words, stage from that area if we needed to. In other words, a large base like Elmendorf would have a forward operating location like Galena that it could go to and stage from, so it's a little bit closer, let's say, to the action.
Other forward operating sites involved in Amalgam Warrior are King Salmon and Eielson Air Force Bases. This field training exercise is designed to teach soldiers how to shift from peacetime operations in the event that an armed attack takes place against the U.S. or Canada. The crew will operate F-15 fighter planes from the base here. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. To hear Senator Bert Sharp tell it, the Department of Fish and Game spends too much time researching and not enough time managing. So he's for cutting Fish and Game's budget, in part because the department's not following his intensive game management law, a law that puts hunters ahead of predators. Sharp gets upset when he hears game managers say they need more time and money for research.
We spend $16 million a year just on game management, all that money comes from hunters fishing, hunters license and fishing license and trapping permits and so forth. And we're not going to continue pouring $16 million down the rat hole just to keep someone working that wants to study it and not do anything about it.
Sharp says game managers know enough to evenly divvy up game between hunters and predators. But Terry Boyer, a wildlife professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says to meet Sharp's goal, biologists will actually need more money.
It could be fairly expensive. It's essential that good population estimates are associated with population management so that populations aren't inadvertently over-harvested. And at least for some populations, those detailed kinds of data are not now available.
Boyer says every habitat can only support so many animals. It's called the carrying capacity. He says when a herd size reaches the carrying capacity, the birth weight of calves and their survival chances both go down. Dick Bishop, who heads up the Alaska Outdoor Council, agrees in part. But Bishop says you don't need to launch an intensive study to manage intensively, especially since few herds push their habitats that hard.
I don't think there are many, if any, instances where it has been very clear that big game prey species have reached carrying capacity in Alaska, unless that carrying capacity was temporarily reduced by something like a severe winter, which limited the access of the animals to the available habitat.
Bishop says existing data plus routine management should be enough to prevent game populations from crashing, and he and the Outdoor Council support Sharp's proposed cuts. But game board member Ann Ruggles doesn't agree. She points to the Nelchina caribou herd as a current example of a game at or beyond its habitat's carrying capacity.
If the decision is made to carry out intensive management in a number of areas, we're going to have to concentrate resources there and make these measurements more frequently. Look at the health of the forage plants, look at population estimates, look at calf weights, look at twinning rates and so forth, so that we can monitor these populations through time and know how well we are doing relative to maintaining healthy habitats.
Ruggles wonders if cuts to fish and game plus the legislative mandate to manage game intensively aren't at cross purposes, a question the Senate will also ponder as it takes up the department's budget Wednesday. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Before retiring last year, Butch Goodnow worked as an operator in the Fort Greeley power plant, but he says he could no longer remain a federal employee given all the problems he sees with the current form of government. For 3 weeks now, he's been in jail for driving without a license. He contests the charge, saying under common law, he can't be bound by a contract he doesn't accept.
Last October, I revoked my signature off my driver's license and I sent it back to DMV in Juneau. And I sent them paperwork showing them it was my right not to have a license and to be able to travel. Under the Constitution, you can travel on any common law, highway, roadway, trail, waterway, whatever it is, it's common law because we the people own the United States. So the government doesn't own it, we do.
Goodnow is among a small group of Alaskans who argue that most of the laws governing Americans are unconstitutional. It takes a while to learn the language. For example, he declares himself a sovereign, free from paying income tax. He quotes often from the Constitution and Black's Law Dictionary, where he finds definitions to fuel his arguments. So he wasn't driving, he was traveling, and he doesn't make income, so he needn't pay that tax. Goodnow says his arguments are clear to anyone who understands the Constitution.
This is probably one of the highest profile cases, and I don't know, they'll probably dismiss it before I get before a jury anyway. But I want to go before a jury because if you put all the information out there, the truth stands by itself. And as far as I'm concerned, I've got God and I've got case law behind me. So I don't worry about it. We will beat them. When the Constitution says that you're right, it's your right.
Goodnow says he'll represent himself before the court, saying lawyers work for the court and therefore can't truly represent a client's best interest. He's getting advice, though, from organizations in California and Arizona and his friend Gene Ottenstrohr, another sovereign from Delta, who admits their message can seem complicated to the uninitiated.
The biggest problem that we're running into right now with it is people don't understand because they've never been taught this way. You know, they've been totally government programmed, so they think that what we're doing is totally bad. you know, like, oh, well, look at these lawbreakers, and that's not what we are at all. Actually, we're upholding a more tighter form of law than they are.
Huttenstorer says under common law, a drunk driver suffers no penalty unless he causes damage. Property damage is subject to a sevenfold fine, and a drunk driver who kills someone pays with his own life. Both Ottenstrahler and Goodnow say the freemen in Montana are misunderstood. The bogus money orders they issued are just a small-scale version of government debt.
As far as I'm concerned, there's nothing the matter with the freemen, per se. But they try to blow it up like we're racists. We want to take down the government. The only thing we want to do is go back to legitimate government. What we want is our republic back.
Goodnow doesn't advocate violence. He prefers to fight his battles in court. For state law enforcers, though, people like Goodnow can be a thorn in the side. Assistant Attorney General Dean Guinelli says all visitors and residents of the state of Alaska are subject to the same laws, and with freemen, their challenges end up being dealt with like any other.
It almost comes down to a matter of it's their philosophy as to the way things ought to be rather than the way things really are. And it's very hard to get across to people who have a deep, abiding distrust of government that they still have to comply with its laws. These kinds of challenges rarely have any success.
Guinelli predicts that Goodnow's challenge will get him nowhere, and that he'll eventually tone down his efforts when he sees the system won't capitulate. Goodnow admits there are few people willing to risk jail for their beliefs, but he says a growing number of people are becoming disaffected with government policy, and if he's successful, the movement will gain new power.
As far as I'm concerned, this is an issue that's worth fighting for. It's rights, and once I beat them, they'll know it's my right, and they'll leave me alone.
Goodnow's being held on $2,000 cash bail. His case goes to court next month. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. 3, 2, 1. More than 50 people turned out Wednesday night to share their memories of Creamer's Field, a farm turned popular wildlife refuge and viewing area. It was the third in a series of meetings where people are telling stories about what they remember from living in Fairbanks. Putt Clark is coordinating the Communities of Memory project in Fairbanks. She says the group's hoping to establish a common understanding.
We've come to recognize in Alaska that we have such a high transiency rate here that a lot of people have come in. There's this huge influx of people in Alaska that don't know the history of Alaska, you know, of a community.
In addition to Fairbanks, the Alaska Humanities Forum provided funding for 8 other towns to start their own programs. Clark says the Fairbanks group decided to spread the events over several days. Other communities are coming together for an entire weekend.
We're holding oral events where we talk and have storytelling, and it's actually very important to have an audience, that this is not just people recording stories on to video and audio, which we are doing, but we want to have this sense of community happen by having the audience there and people interacting.
So far, the group's hosted 3 meetings. In December, they shared Christmas memories. Another meeting drew people to tell stories about life on interior rivers. The next meeting will focus on industrial changes like mining and the pipeline. Project funding lasts for 3 years. After the stories are told, organizers will look for someone to transcribe, archive, and copy the recordings so they may be widely used. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
What we can access is all the flights and hotels and rental cars in the domestic market, which is the states and Canada, and international.
As with so many applications today, a personal computer allows McGrath resident Laura Knight to dabble in the travel business right from her own house. In between homeschooling and otherwise caring for her 6 children with her husband, the travel school graduate finds time to make arrangements for local customers via the family telephone and computer.
I'm hooked up with the Apollo system, which comes right out of Denver, and we can access anything that any other computer system can access.
With the travel world at her fingertips, like agents everywhere, Knight tries to find the best deals on airline, hotel, and rental car reservations for her bush customers.
So a lot of times I can come up with a better fare than the airlines can.
through the computer. I just have more access to different fares than just the straight fares that are offered. Like, for instance, I could break it in different cities that the airlines wouldn't do. They wouldn't take the time to do that. They'll have just straight fares that are broken at certain places. And I can try different things and try to get people, you know, just kind of travel them around. And
though there's limited opportunity to make big money in just the McGrath market, Knight does handle arrangements for the locally based Iditarod area school district and says there is an advantage to operating out of the bush.
Everybody has to fly in order to get out, and they don't necessarily have to have a travel agent, but a lot of times the Penn Airlines are busy or they're only open until 6 o'clock and people can't get through. So I can get in on the computer 24 hours a day.
Because it's not worth the bonding, special printer, and safe necessary to actually ticket her customers in McGrath, Knight gives up half of the standard 10% agent commission to Apollo Travel in Anchorage for ticketing, something she says at this point isn't a big concern for the family business.
Because right now we're really in training, you know, and really I just feel like it's a service that we can offer out here.
Even if she's not making much money, Knight says with advertising, there is room for the business to grow when she and her family are ready. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
3, 2, 1. The State Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys compiles data on the mineral resources on lands across the state. Earlier this year, Governor Knowles proposed saving money by rolling the survey into the Division of Oil and Gas. The legislature overrode the governor's plan, and Representative Joe Green sponsored an alternative bill to roll the geologists in with the Division of Mining.
I'm concerned that as it is now, they're just kind of floundering out there without a director, and that they're very vulnerable to either be zero-funded and non-existent, or that there will be another executive order issued maybe next year, and if that happens, they could be swallowed up and there is no more DGGS.
Green says as a former director of the Division of Oil and Gas, he was sympathetic to fears that the state's geologists would be diverted from their work on mining into oil development. But miners opposed either option. Roger Burgraff fears that consolidation will reduce the agency's independence.
If you roll it into an agency, another agency, their focus is going to be regulatory. If it's oil and gas or minerals. And with short budgets, they're going to concentrate on doing the regulatory bit rather than the research, which I feel is essential.
Burgraff says the survey assists the mining industry by compiling detailed maps that companies use to find minerals. But researchers also model groundwater movements and other natural resources, providing objective information for many uses. Richard Hughes, project manager at the Ryan Lode Mine, credits the survey with helping keep mining strong, and while he agrees in general with turning government functions over to the private sector, he says consolidating the agency to save one director's job would be expensive in the long run.
The industry would do it if the states didn't, but the problem with that is that the little guy, it would become big company business only. The little guy can't afford to do that incredible research that's being done by the organization. And anything that's done by big companies is for their use only. It wouldn't be privy to anybody else.
Hughes and others turned out in force last month to lobby against the bill. It looks like their efforts paid off, sort of. Green says he's going to let the bill die in the House Resources Committee, but he doesn't think the issue's going away.
I may be wrong, but having been there, I'm just concerned that they are going to lose their identity, and it'll be too late if they come back next year and say, hey, we go in with DOG, and 3 or 4 years from now, people ask, whatever happened to DGGS? I don't want them come tapping at my door. I tried.
Green says as lawmakers keep the pressure on to reduce the budget, even survey supporters may not have enough metal to stave off future cuts. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Darlene Belts is the technical advisor for the Trampling Tobacco Campaign in Alaska. She helps people who are concerned about tobacco use and travels across the state presenting tobacco awareness information to all age groups. Belts is targeting children as part of her anti-smoking message because, according to the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance, nearly 90% of adult tobacco users got started by the time they were 18.
We're trying to recruit and work more with the youth as well. We'd like to develop a youth section to our STEM group where we can tap into the young people to find out, you know, what could, you know, what really works in prevention. What can they do to help out in this preventative work for having other young children not to start using tobacco?
Canada Chiefs Conference Health and Safety Coordinator Margie Atla travels to schools in the Galena area to speak about tobacco use and other health issues relevant in the bush. She says kids start smoking because of peer pressure and because their parents do. Atla says kids need to know what tobacco use can do to their bodies.
We start right from preschools now and telling them about smoking. And one of the films I have is, it shows where this character is trying to get up the hill, and the other one that's a smoker shows how much trouble he's having climbing that mountain.
Ella recently spoke to students at the Ella B. Vernetti School in Keokuk. They learned from her and each other that just because something looks cool doesn't mean it is.
What's your name?
Presley.
Do you smoke?
No.
Do you know anybody who smokes?
I don't think so.
Do you know anything about smoking?
I know you could get cancer from.
Very good. What's your name?
Vincent.
Do you smoke?
No.
Did you use to smoke?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about smoking?
You can get cancer and you can die from it.
Do you know anybody who smoked?
My mom, my grandpa, my grandma.
But Atlas says it is not enough to tell kids in schools about the harms of tobacco. She says parents have to be involved. They should know that even secondhand smoke can affect their kids.
That's when you know your smoking is really harming your kids, is how many times they've been in the clinic due to colds and flu. And now it's getting to bronchitis and pneumonia. So like it if the parents could buy the cigarettes.
The Trampling Tobacco Campaign recognizes that education is not the only way to decrease tobacco use across the state. Officials are lobbying to increase the state's tobacco tax. Alaska's tax is below the national average, even though the state has the fifth highest rate of tobacco-related deaths in the nation. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
More than 100 Valdez City residents showed up Tuesday night looking for answers about the prison plan. They spent almost 3 hours listening to officials from Corrections Group North, and one of the main messages they heard was the company needs quick approval or the proposal may evaporate. Mayor John Harris says that means there's no time to hold a public referendum, so he expects the city council to vote sometime in the next couple weeks. But Councilman Brian Johnson says he's not ready to decide such a big question.
I don't know where the rest of the council is on this, but my preference was to go to a vote of the people on this issue, and I haven't really changed my mind on that, so I'm one of seven right now.
Corrections Group North is a consortium of three companies, Alvest, Wackenhut, and Vico. The group is offering to convert Harborview Developmental Center into a 200-bed medium security prison once it closes next year. Harborview currently serves about 40 severely handicapped people. Johnson is joined by Councilman Dave Cobb, who says he too wants a public vote. Cobb notes the private proposal comes at the same time as a state plan for turning Harborview into a 50-bed substance abuse treatment center for prisoners.
So I certainly wouldn't favor either one of them right now, and I'm certainly not going to do away with either one of them right now until we can make a decision. You know, based on facts, I'm not ready to make a decision.
Alvest President Bill Weimar doubts lawmakers will support the state's plan, and to get his moving, he needs the city's approval. Weimar says the new prison will make up for many of the jobs lost to Harborview's closure and that current employees will be high on the hire list. He also says private prisons are a hot topic in Juneau, with one legislator pushing a 1,000-bed facility and Governor Knowles backing a multi-million-dollar bond package to expand existing correctional facilities.
That is what the prison expansion plan for the future looks like, and Valdez is not included. So that's why it needs to be done now, or it's probably not going to get done.
Weimar argues the private plan will sell well as an alternative to the current practice of sending prisoners to Arizona.
If the city council moves, and moves with conviction and that they really want to do this and that they want to go and make the case of bringing that money back from Arizona and putting it to work in Valdez, we will work with them to make that happen. But until we have an indication of that kind of support from them, that they're willing to do that, I mean, really, our stuff, what we can do is limited. it's limited to what we've basically done tonight. We can explain what we propose to do and urge people to take action. But it's up to people of Valdez at this point.
As the legislative session winds down, city council members know they'll have to vote soon if they want to support the private plan. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
The pansies and petunias are seeded, the geraniums are up, there are daisies and carnations and all sorts of varieties sprouting at the university greenhouse. Lab assistant Pat Wagner says though they've started leeks and peppers, they're holding off on most of the vegetables.
If you have too big a transplant into your garden, then you actually lose ground for a lot of things. And then the tendency to shock them and for them to be set back a little is greater. You need just the right stage. Not too big, not too little.
Wagner says in another week or two, the big airy greenhouses will be jammed with transplants for the Georgetown Botanical Gardens. She and Grant Mateke work with researchers and in these tight budget years, an increasing core of volunteers. Their prime job, Mateke says, is testing techniques and varieties to see what grows best in a northern environment.
Any kind of horticultural crop, anything that you'd be growing in your family food garden or in your perennial beds or in your flower or your annual flower beds. You can come into our garden and see the benefit of not only our research but the accumulated knowledge of everybody that's been growing things in Fairbanks since the Gold Rush days.
The greenhouse tests perennials and over 300 varieties of annuals every year. It looks at mulching to raise soil temperatures, rooting and reproduction techniques, warm and cold crops. Mateke says the work they do stretches the imagination.
A lot of people have an idea of how we're limited in the breadth and kinds of things that we can grow. And although there are some limits in what we can grow, there's a much wider variety of things that we can grow than most people realize.
The most important thing to know about gardening in Alaska right now, he says, is it's time to get started.
Because as our old boss used to say, I'll trade you 10 days in the fall for one day in the spring. That's when our soils start to warm up. And so if you get your garden in on June 15th instead of June 1st, or things that are a little bit frost tolerant on June 1st instead of May 15th, you've lost a lot of ground here.
On the other hand, don't rush too much. You can shovel off the garden plot, but if you then get inspired to plant the seedlings you've nurtured in the living room window, you might just get frosted.
You know, some years you can gamble and really win big, and some years you lose. So you just have to have your backup in place if you're going to try and put stuff out real early and get in the ground early.
The best advice, Wagner says, is to make a good plan and make sure you've planned for what you like to eat and see.
And in terms of the vegetables, it's a real good idea just for the health of the plants to try and have a rotation plan so that you can grow different families of plants in different areas each year. You reduce your disease problems and pest problems as well.
Once you've got the plan, Mateke says up at the farm there's still lots to do inside.
Nice time to do all that kind of landscape construction that you can do indoors and get a little jump on the season. And never hurts to make sure your rototiller is functioning if you have one, and clean your tools up and stuff like that. All those kinds of things that at least before we had volunteers, we never had time to do, and now we're starting to have time to do. But just to get yourself ready for the season, anything you can think of that you can do now, do.
In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. 3, 2, 1. The State Game Board needs some definitions, says Senator Bert Sharp, and his bill aims to give them. Sharp says since his intensive management bill became law 2 years ago, the board's been floundering on its language.
The last two or three game board, board of game meetings, the department or a board member questioned what the term harvestable surplus meant, what exactly high level of human harvest meant, what is sustained yield. Sustained yield is dictated by the Constitution but never defined in statute as it is for forestry products, fisheries, and others.
Now, Sharp's bill defines, among other things, what percentage of surplus game goes to humans. Senate Bill 77 forces fish and game to manage wolves and bears so hunters get 10 times more meat. And many hunters like Sharp's bill. But game managers and biologists are bucking. The Alaska chapter of the Wildlife Society is asking Governor Knowles to veto SB 77. Ellen Campbell, the chapter's president, says the bill ignores basic biology.
Also, the other point is that something that's enacted into law does not allow the flexibility often to manage population changes or changes in habitat. So we're concerned that we may be boxing ourselves into something that we can't get out of very easily.
Not all biologists agree. While some acknowledge management by legislation's dangerous, they say where fish and game once managed for hunters, the department's now hamstrung by trying to manage for conflicting viewpoints, including those opposed to killing animals. Legislation may be their only chance, they say, to even the balance. But Campbell and others point to California as an object lesson against ballot box biology. Voters 6 years ago shut down hunting for mountain lions. California Fish and Game spokesman Evan Nossoff says now managers' hands are tied.
The problem is we've had a couple people killed in the last couple years. The mountain lion population appears to be growing, and there are some places where it would be very beneficial to the mountain lions and to the people to thin the herd, but that's not allowed under this law.
California lawmakers are trying to find ways of handing some control back to game managers, but Nossoff says it takes a nearly impossible 4/5 vote to overturn the law. Management by legislation in Alaska cuts both ways. While many hunters support Sharp's efforts at directing management, they oppose a ballot initiative they fear will eliminate aerial wolf control. Voters get a shot at that initiative in November. Governor Knowles must act on SB 77 by Friday. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Where would we be without ice? It keeps our drinks cold, allows us winter access, supplies rushing rivers, and presents us with innumerable other challenges. Today on Alaska Express, a tribute to ice. We'll start in Fairbanks, where 2 weeks ago, ice carvers from across the world spent 10 days competing in world championships. John McWhorter has more.
Armed with a 4-inch chisel, Tony Parker is paring down what will soon become the tail end of 30 feet of angry sperm whale. At his side, Captain Ahab hangs from a harpoon while a boatload of his shipmates look on in awe. It's a common expression among visitors to the ice park, where 2 weeks ago, carvers like Parker turned 4-foot ice cubes into detailed sculpture.
Basically, it's like taking a piece of crystal that doesn't really shatter, you know, and you can mold anything you want. Because when you're finally done with it, that's basically what it looks like. It is a piece of crystal, and it's like making this beautiful art form. You know, you have to be real. You got to have so much equipment to make like glass and crystal and things like that. With ice, you know, a chisel, a chainsaw, little things like that, a knife, you can create things. Anybody can do it.
On this day, barely 24 hours before judges will call a halt to the work, carvers perform a frenzied ballet. They're stacking, grinding, chipping, shaving, and of course, sawing, while all the time fighting warm temperatures that destroy the strength and structure these carvers depend on.
You create what you want out of it. Unfortunately, it melts, but it's something you can do over and over and over. It's not something where it costs a lot of money. You know, water is not the most expensive product, and it's something that, you know, a lot of people can get into inexpensively, rather than wood carvers where you have to buy the wood and marble and things like that. You know, ice is probably the cheapest form of art you can start into, realistically, because it's the cleanest. You carve what you want to carve, you let it melt, there's no cleanup. The water goes away, you don't have wood chips to throw away. That's what's kind of nice about it, what draws a lot of people to it. You do it, it's up, it's gone, you know, no more.
It's a perfect art form for Alaska, a place where sooner, usually not later, nature wins all battles.
a place where carvers of all sorts find it's easier to accept the land's gifts, knowing full well that they must soon be returned. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Moving from carving ice to carving mountains, another group of people has gathered in Valdez for this weekend's World Extreme Skiing Championship. Greg Williams has more.
The 6th annual World Extreme Skiing Championships are taking place this weekend in the Chugach Mountains near Valdez. 34 competitors from 7 countries will put their skills to the test on 40 to 50 degree slopes. Helicopters will bring them to the top, and how well they make their way down will determine who gets the world's top male and female extreme skier crowns. The competitors will be judged according to such things as the difficulty of the runs they make, the technique they use, and how much control they exert. More than 400 inches of snow has fallen at Thompson Pass this year, less than normal. Because of that, Todd Jones, a guide with Valdez Heli Ski Guides, predicts a more technically challenging West this year, requiring more heads-up skiing.
Where you see snow isn't necessarily where you can ski. You can't just launch any cliff. You kind of got to pick your way through, look where there's going to be good snow, ski a little more controlled technical lines, stuff like that. This year is going to probably work a lot better than just skiing wide open, launching big airs and speedering, because it's a lot more exposed rocks. It could be a lot more dangerous just if you're really skiing wide open.
The competition will get underway tomorrow on Odyssey Mountain, easily viewed from the Richardson Highway just north of Thompson Pass. The sites of Sunday and Monday's competition have not yet been announced. Tuesday is set aside as a weather day if needed, but otherwise the winners of WESC 1996 should be announced during an award ceremony Monday night. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Over in the Alaska Range, the Ruth Gorge holds one of the world's narrowest and deepest glaciers. Kathy Sullivan has the story of measuring the Ruth Glacier.
For thousands of years, tremendous amounts of snow and ice from the south side of Mount McKinley have fallen to the valley floor. Squeezed by time and motion, it has formed a glacier that moves at 3 feet per day. In 1991, Bradford Washburn, believing the gorge must be damn deep, asked glaciologist Keith Eckelmeyer if the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska could help find out just how deep the gorge was. Eckelmeyer and others used a radar system in 91, but left unable to say anything except that it really was damn deep. In 1992, Washburn, Eckelmeyer, and 5 other researchers tried again.
We used seismic methods. We put some dynamite in a hole and blow it up, and then it makes elastic waves go basically down to the bottom of the glacier and bounce off the bottom and come up. And then we record how long that takes. Then we can determine where the waves came from, so we can see that some bounce off the sides and some from the bottom. And they travel through the glacier, and the glacier's almost entirely ice. It's 99.9% ice. It's very little rock. The only rock that's there is a little bit on the surface, most of the rock is just a little rock along the surface of the glacier that accumulates as rock falls onto it.
Their findings showed the glacier to be 3,800 feet deep for people camped in the gorge. Mount Dickey towers 5,000 feet above, and a wall of granite cliffs throw shadows across this moving river of ice. The Ruth Gorge brings people every year from around the world to climb and view its spectacular beauty. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Climbers might flock to granite, but they also flock to ice. When he was a younger man, writer John Krakauer ascended the Devil's Thumb, which juts out of the Witch's Cauldron Glacier near Petersburg. In a passage from his book, Into the Wild, he reflects on his solo climb.
Early on a difficult climb, especially a difficult solo climb, you constantly feel the abyss pulling at your back. To resist takes a tremendous conscious effort. You don't dare let your guard down for an instant. But as the climb goes on, you grow accustomed to the exposure. You get used to rubbing shoulders with doom. You come to believe in the reliability of your hands and feet and head. You learn to trust your self-control. Hours slide by like minutes. The accumulated clutter of day-to-day existence, the lapses of conscience, the unpaid bills, the bungled opportunities, the dust under the couch, the inescapable prison of your genes, all of that is temporarily forgotten, crowded from your thoughts by an overpowering clarity of purpose and by the seriousness of the task at hand. I'd gained nearly 700 feet of altitude since stepping off the hanging glacier, all of it on crampon front points and the picks of my axis. The The ribbon of frozen meltwater had ended 300 feet up and was followed by a crumbly armor of frost feathers. Though just barely substantial enough to support body weight, the rime was plastered over the rock to a thickness of 2 or 3 feet, so I kept plugging upward. The wall, however, had been growing imperceptibly steeper, and as it did so, the frost feathers became thinner. I'd fallen into a slow, hypnotic rhythm, swing, swing, kick, kick, swing, swing, kick, kick, when my left ice axe slammed into a slab of diorite a few inches beneath the rime. I tried to the left, then right, but kept striking rocks. The frost feathers holding me up, it became apparent, were maybe 5 inches thick and had the structural integrity of stale cornbread. Below was 3,700 feet of air, and I was balanced on a house of cards. The sour taste of panic rose in my throat. My eyesight blurred. I began to hyperventilate. My calves started to shake. I shuffled a few feet farther to the right, hoping to find thicker ice, but managed only to bend an ice axe on the rock. Awkwardly, stiff with fear, I started working my way back down. The rime gradually thickened. After descending about 80 feet, I got back on reasonably solid ground. I stopped for a long time to let my nerves settle, then leaned back from my tools and stared up at the face above, searching for a hint of solid ice, for some variation in the underlying rock strata, for anything that would allow passage over the frosted slabs. I looked until my neck ached, but nothing appeared. The climb was over. The only place to go was down.
John Krakauer reading from Into the Wild. Thanks to KCHU's Greg Williams and climber Chuck Comstock for their ice sounds.
The exam replaces the Iowa Basic Skills Test. Superintendent for the school district, Norm Polanski, says the California test seems to have benefits and still answer important questions for the district. He says standardized tests make students accountable.
I think standardized tests is always good. It gives us an opportunity to know how we compare to other states as far as averages and so on. It gives us an opportunity also to know what areas we might look to improve in and what areas we're doing well in.
Polanski says the California test will cost less, and because the test will be returned back to the school sooner, teachers will be able to discuss the results with students before summer vacation. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
If you're an active internet user, you may also be a problem for the local phone company. And if you're not, your neighbor probably is. The headache is a byproduct of how attractive cyberspace has become to computer users. They were single-handedly responsible for a 12% increase in local phone calls last year in Fairbanks, and nearly $400,000 in lost revenue for the phone company. That's because when users dial up the internet, they tie up a phone line. Spend an hour online, and other phone users may hear this.
We're sorry. Due to heavy calling, we cannot complete your call at this time. Will you please hang up and try your call later? If your call is urgent, please try again now. This is a recording.
MUS is trying to stay ahead by putting in extra lines. But network services manager Larry Hamsley says the company's in the hole and something's got to give.
Well, it has to. I mean, we have to, sooner or later, we have to reach a point that it's not costing us money. And right now it's costing us money. Strictly for internet access, it's costing us money.
If Fairbanks had more people and MUS was working with the latest technology, there wouldn't be a problem. With plenty of room to expand, growing internet use would just mean a chance to sell more phone lines and make more money. For rural areas, relatively few people and older systems just means trouble. Doug Tolley is president of PolarNet, an internet service provider. He says MUS is not alone.
The rapid growth in the last several months of the internet has definitely put stress on communications companies, local phone companies, companies that manufacture modems and all the other pieces that go into making the internet work. It's grown either faster than people anticipated or faster than people are able to keep up with.
Tolley says since the internet isn't going away, users are likely to continue tying up local lines. That means MUS may be in a bind. Voters repeatedly deny bond issues, and neither the feds nor the state have much to offer. Hamsley says the local phone company is likely to turn to the user.
people are coming up with high use tariffs, meaning the cost causer will be the cost payer. And I think what will happen is you'll see a certain level set, and if you go beyond that, then you will pay additional costs for your phone service.
Hensley says MUS hasn't settled on anything, but it's considering a 12.5-hour monthly ceiling. Washington telecommunications analyst Bill Bain says user tariffs might be a good short-term solution, providing phone users don't revolt. But over the long term, Internet users may be a phone company's best customers because they're heavy users and willing to invest in innovation. Bain says picking a user pay solution might backfire for local phone companies in today's competitive market.
So in doing good for society, they may be doing bad to themselves, because they could be creating price umbrellas for competitors to come in and compete with them and cherry-pick the segments of users who may be long-term the most financially attractive customers for the telephone company. So in winning the battle long-term, they could lose the war.
No change in local billing is anticipated anytime soon. MUS says the subject is still under consideration. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The National Park Service is making its seasonal move onto Mount McKinley this week. With the help of the Army's High Altitude Rescue Team from Fort Wainwright, the Park Service will transport everything necessary to create the two base camps on the mountain that it staffs during the yearly climbing season, one camp at 7,000 feet and another at 14,000. The Army has been assisting with the yearly move since the 1970s. Its Chinook helicopters can carry as much as 20,000 pounds of gear. The mission allows the high-altitude rescue team to practice flying and landing at high elevations. During last year's climbing season, the team performed their highest elevation rescue ever at 19,600 feet. Everything from medical supplies, oxygen bottles, propane tanks, and climbing equipment will be flown up. Cases of food, including 20 dozen bagels, will sustain the rangers on duty there. And a new outhouse, built by volunteer Andrew Ackerman, will add to the two already on McKinley. This week, the gear will be dropped off and cached on the mountain. Starting May 1st, the high-altitude mountaineering rangers of Talkeetna will begin their three-month residence on Mount McKinley. Their first job? Build their home. In Talkeetna, this is Bonnie Ann Schweitzer.
Three, two, one. Last week, a sharp-dressed Chicago lawyer circulated through the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He talked to engineers and scientists, producers and editors, explaining the intricacies of patents, logos, and copyrights. Jack Shore came to Fairbanks doing what he does a lot these days, telling universities how to get the biggest buck for their brains.
The universities, for the most part, no longer have government funding. They look to individual corporate funding. Corporate funding has simply a profit motive. The only way they can enhance that profit motive is to protect their intellectual property. So you go through that evolutionary process, which you won't get funding from a private source if that private source can't see a benefit, and that benefit is going to be intellectual property, which they want protected.
Shore says foreign countries finance a lot of American research today, cashing in on our expertise, especially in biotechnology. Shore's trip was financed by the University of Alaska Technological Development Corporation. Vice President Merritt Helfrich says UA's situation isn't as dire as some schools. It has strong federal support. But he says the university recognizes that might not always be the case.
This intellectual power, which is represented in the University of Alaska system, can, we feel, bring benefits not only in money to the university, but to the formation of new businesses and expanded opportunities for Alaskans, as well as people elsewhere.
Helfrich says the university has yet to turn a profit, but it will come, and creators also gain in the arrangement. Jerry Brigham, who heads up Alaska One in Fairbanks, hopes so. The public television station is licensed to the university, and state cuts to public broadcasting have Brigham and other managers scrambling for innovative ways to stay on the air. Brigham says producers went to the vaults, dusted off some old programs, and thought about marketing them to new audiences. After meeting with patent attorney Shore, he says the station's on the right track.
We had already started on our own looking into this, but we feel that some very interesting points that we hadn't thought of had been firmed up with this. And, yeah, we're going to make a big push starting this year, both in this country and internationally.
Brigham hopes that a fishing series planned for Alaska public stations next year might eventually attract broadcasters in other countries, filling the station's coffers with needed francs, marks, and yen. And now, other UA scientists, writers, and engineers are joining Brigham, looking to market their moxie. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A week ago, several council members said they were far from ready to vote for the 200-bed medium security prison, but now Councilman Tim Plummer says with two exceptions, a landslide of calls has him supporting plans to convert the Harborview Developmental Center after it closes next year.
I believe that this is the right thing to do. I think we've clearly determined that there isn't any other alternative for Harborview. I'm not going to see and allow 100 jobs to go away without doing everything I can possibly do to find a way to replace those jobs or something that will replace those jobs. And that's what I did tonight.
Plummer joined six other council members in voicing their unanimous backing of the plan. Many Harborview workers are applauding the vote. Harborview union steward Brett Hill says the workers will be glad somebody's finally doing something for them.
We've had all kinds of promises from the state about what they were going to do with the facility to keep our jobs, and none of them ever materialized. And we're all fed up with that process. We're sick and tired of hearing what might happen. This proposal tonight at least shows us that the city council is going to move forward and try to really secure something for us as far as jobs go.
The plan calls for Corrections Group North, a consortium of Wackenhut, Vico, and Allvest, to spend $8 million to $12 million to convert the facility. He'll sign an agreement with the group Monday that puts Harborview employees first in line for prison jobs. He says almost 70% of the workers he's spoken with support the project. Mayor John Harris says Harborview can't close without something to take its place.
You know, with almost an $8 million budget, and you take that out of the community, it makes a major impact on the community. If you use a conservative figure of three, it could take as much as $24 million out of the community in rollover money that people spend in one place and then they get spent in another and it rolls over. If you take that amount, of money out of a community this size, it makes a major impact.
While the council supports the plan, backers are still far from pouring concrete. Harris says the project still needs the backing of the Knowles administration and the legislature. The city and Corrections Group North are looking for a 20-year commitment to fill the 200-bed facility at a price that will earn the operators a profit. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
In the same way a home buyer needs mortgage insurance, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority needs a policy to guarantee the bonds itself. AIDS is looking to finance $85 million, its share of the $267 million needed to build the Healy Clean Coal Project. The insurance comes from banks in the form of a letter of credit. SeaFirst Bank in Seattle offered the letter, but withdrew the deal when it found out the legislature was planning to take $21 million from AIDA to help balance the state budget. The International Bank of Japan has also refused to bid on the letter. AIDA was planning to sell bonds this spring while interest rates are favorable, but AIDA Director Riley Snell says that's on hold until the legislature and governor finish with the budget.
There are nervous bankers out there and people that we rely upon to raise the monies that we need to do these types of projects, so it creates an atmosphere and an environment of unrest and uncertainty, which isn't good when you're in the financing business.
Snell likens taking money from AIDA to robbing seed corn and says in the long run, doing so may damage AIDA's ability to finance and build other large projects like the expansion of the Red Dog Mine near Kotzebue. Snell'd like to see AIDA's contributions be part of a long-term strategy to reduce the debt rather than a yearly let's see what AIDA's got focus. The Senate minority raised that issue Tuesday, but speaking from the Senate floor, Steve Frank says AIDA's big enough to pay back the state some of the money it's received over the years.
They have a net worth of $750 million capitalized by the state. They have earnings last year of $32 million, this year $37 million. this is an amount that would share about half their earnings and still leave them plenty of money to pay their debt service and, of course, to do their ongoing program. This would in no way impact their ability to do their ongoing program, nor would it jeopardize any bond rating.
Ada currently has a AA- bond rating in the financial markets, and Snell says that's pretty good. But if it falls, borrowing money will be more expensive. As for the coal project, Snell says financing's not yet a problem. Ada can continue spending federal cash to keep things moving into the summer, and once the budget's finished, the agency can put together a financing plan. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The banks are nervous based on what they have seen as the majority's plan to take a dividend from the authority. Our way of dealing with this at this time is to just put the process on hold until we can complete the legislative session.
For many years, or for a number of years, EPA was not enforcing very well, and actually in some cases at all, the Clean Water Act with respect to placer miners in Alaska.
By demanding that 40-mile operators, dredgers and operators, be require individual permits, they are not. They are refusing to allow us under the general permit. Essentially, that is an attempt to force everybody out of the mining business in the 40-mile because the individual permits are subject to a long, drawn-out process and frivolous objections from any individual or group who chooses to do so.
Three, two, one. Game managers and volunteers at Creamer's Field have cleared snow and scattered grain, preparing to welcome the thousands of geese and other waterfowl that yearly drop in on their way north. Managers are also gearing up to answer the many questions Creamer's visitors pose about the birds and the natural world that supports them. But if planned cuts to Fish and Game's budget take hold, the Creamer's educational program and many others around the state like it may disappear. That's why Fish and Game biologist John Shane is locally spearheading Teaming with Wildlife. He says the national effort may eventually fund educational programs.
This is a national initiative sponsored by a coalition of all the state 50 state fish and game agencies to come up with an alternative funding system to support non-game fish and wildlife conservation, outdoor recreation, and wildlife education.
The idea, says Shane, is to levy a charge on outdoor gear, much as hunters are now taxed on guns and ammunition to pay for game management. Shane says the cost is imposed on manufacturers and capped at 5%. Proponents will introduce a bill for the program next month in Congress. Shane underscores Teaming with Wildlife will not only benefit wildlife education programs, but conservation.
It's all of the other species, the 88% in Alaska of the species that are neither hunted or fished or listed as threatened or endangered that can fall through the cracks. And we want to spend some energy and management time on those species so we can be more proactive and do a better job with conservation.
Hunters should embrace this program, Shane says, because now money they pay in taxes can be expressly targeted for game management. Amen, says Dick Bishop, director of the Alaska Outdoor Council. He often points out that hunters contribute the lion's share of Fish and Game's budget. It's also why his group supports cuts to Creamer's Field and other educational programs. Not, he says, because they aren't good programs, but because the dollars that should be going into management are being bled off for other purposes. But, he adds, the council didn't support Teaming with Wildlife last year.
At that point, there just wasn't enough information. Now more information is coming along. We are looking at it again. We want to make sure that that it doesn't divert monies, for example, from projects that would, from hunting, fishing, trapping type projects and that sort of thing, and that some consideration be given to the fact that hunters, trappers, and fishers have supported most of the conservation effort for 60 years.
Bishop says some hunters oppose Teaming with Wildlife because they'll pay twice the tax, once on guns and ammo and again on outdoor gear. But he acknowledges some hunters worry if Teaming with Wildlife becomes law, it will erode the power hunters have in influencing legislation. While they wouldn't mind sharing the cost of conservation, he says, they're less certain they want to share the power. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.